You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry, KTAH 101.9, Radio Tacoma. Today we're going to have a different program from the normal interview with poets. Steve Niebel, the engineer, has recorded a very fine evening at the Pelican Bay Bookstore, where two poets, one we know well and one new one, read that evening. The first was introduced by Abigail Morgan Prout, Walk Deep, lives on Orcas Island, and produced some wonderful books of her walks, observations of nature, and considerations that weave her life and her family into her works. Also, there is the famous lepidopterist Robert Michael Pyle, or to those who know him more familiarly, it's good old Bob Pyle. And he read that night and commented a great deal on his career and poetry and, of course, butterflies.
Sometimes we don't listen to the grace notes that we should. This is from a eco-resort in the Cascades that Rusty and Libby and I have taught at, too. And there was a sign on the wall of my teaching cabin that was supposed to be all eco-friendly and so on, but it said, "Yellow jackets are so numerous this year. Keeping the doors closed and screens down will help keep your meeting space free of these unwanted creatures." And, you know, I took their ethic as it was meant, but you're going to teach up there in the Icicle Canyon and keep your door shut? No. And the other thing is, there's something about that phrase, unwanted creatures, just kind of stuck in the craw. It's called unwanted creatures. Like tigers in the grasses of the Bay of Bengal, having villagers for lunch. Like bats that flap into bedrooms, leaving rumors of rabies and garlic. Like wolves who snap up afterbirths, and sometimes even calves. Like caterpillars of cabbage whites, turning broccoli into lace. Like bison blamed for bovine TB, and beavers for giardia. Like goats in the Galapagos, and elephants in Maasai crops. The flicker hammering the roof at dawn, the mockingbird chattering the night away, the owl who calls your name at night, that raven on the bust of Pallas who makes it all too clear, Lenore ain't coming back. Like starlings in the city park, spotted owls in old growth woods, crows on the corn rows, even that nightingale in Berkeley Square must have pissed somebody off. Like ants in the pantry, bats in the belfry, bees in the bonnet, moles in the china shop, fleas on the kitty, ticks on the pooch, squirrels in the attic, rats in the roof, slugs in the lettuce, crabs in the crotch, pumas in the playground, coyotes in the lambing field, and snakes and spiders pretty much everywhere. Like prairie dogs digging up the open range, raccoons ransacking the trash, sea lions with a taste for salmon, rabbits at the carrot patch, bears at a picnic, chuggers in the grass, possums on the road, deer through the windshield, skunks on the auto grill, mosquitoes at the barbecue, clothes moths in your woolen socks, midges on the Scottish heath, black flies blotting out the midnight sun, maggots in the Granny Smith, roaches on the kitchen floor, lice in your daughter's hair, tapeworms in the gut, virus in the blood. Like Jews on Kristallnacht, Palestinians on the Temple Mount, blacks on the schoolhouse steps, Indians in Dodge, Tutsis with the Hutu, Muslims with the Serbs, Catholics in Ulster, gays in Laramie, women in the Taliban, everyone to someone else. Unwanted, unwanted all. Be sure and keep the doors closed. And I'll finish from this book on a lighter note, but it's one I'm absolutely sure, and I'll close out from one of the collection, with one that I pretty darn sure you can all relate to. And I better get some chuckles out of this one. It's called The Room of Lost Items. What if you opened a door and there was a room with everything you'd ever lost? The paper flowers you made for your mother that blew away in the snow. All the jackets you left on buses. That scab. The hats alone would fill a long shelf. The heather purple deerstalker, the 3X beaver Stetson Ranger Smokey, the Haas Cartwright 10-gallon that badly needed losing. Remember that beautiful scarf left in the lecture hall? The binoculars that were part of your body for 40 years? The wallets, the gloves, all those things you promised not to lose. And then you walk through this door and they're all here. Oh, the joy, that special sock, that kitten, those keys. But wait, there are people in here too, and versions of your heart in several shapes and states. And the deal is, you have to take them all. Chinook and Chanterelle was published also by Lost Horse Press. But Christine Holbert, the wonderful publisher and designer for that press, is Ukrainian by birth and by heritage. She's publishing only Ukrainian poets now. I had another book to come out from her next year, and her whole list has been dropped except Ukrainian. So my next collection is called The Last Man in Willapa. And it's coming out from Texas Tech University Press in April. I hope to be back for that. And then later in the year, or probably next year, I imagine, from the Cascadia Poetics Lab, who published the fabulous new book, Cascadian Zen, Writings About Cascadia. Jason, the proper name?
Writings About Cascadia, Here and Now.
Writings About Cascadia in the Here and Now. And ask Jason Wirth about that afterwards, if you'd like. They're publishing another collection of mine called Swimming with Snakes, I'm so honored and happy to say, probably already in 25. But the third collection I'm going to read from is a relatively recent book published by Columbia River Reader Press in Longview. And it is a collaboration with my favorite photographer, Judy Vandermaten of Kathlamet. And I have collected and loved her photographs for many years. And we decided to try to do a collaboration, but it took 20 years to find a publisher and get the book right and to put it together. When finally, when Columbia River Reader Press decided to do it, then we had to really produce it. And I decided it was going to be poems, not essays. And basically, I got a year's writing residency on the Columbia. Not really, I'd lived my life, but I spent a year going up and down the tidal reach of the Columbia, only below Bonneville, and writing 44 poems that do not illustrate her photographs or vice versa. They're not captions for the poems, but they illuminate one another is our idea. So this book is back there. And I'm going to read just a very few poems from that to conclude. The subtitle of the book, there's one of her gorgeous pictures that you can relate to from tonight. That's exactly what I saw from Bob and ML's back porch tonight, was nearly full moon rising over the northernmost little appendage of Puget Sound. But the subtitle of the book is Field Guide to the Lower Columbia River in Poems and Pictures. Different kind of field guide. And the book is called The Tidewater Reach. Cottonwoods in March, Willow Grove. After the dance, you drove out Willow Grove, across the bridge beyond the town, between river and backwater slough. The warm night beguiled by cottonwoods all along the bank, just breaking bud, just putting out their soft, green, tongues, all sticky with the brown paste of balsam, once called balm of Gilead. Both of you taken by the cloying scent, far beyond sense. You knew you shouldn't park, but you did, and stroked each other's faces with the soft green spears, cheeks, eyelids, right below the greedy nostrils, lips, lacerating your hearts beyond repair. A pleasure so intense, the two senses least used, smell and touch, that you could never, ever speak it as it was. Barely even kissed. But you both knew, didn't you, that the kisses would come, and you could only hope they would match the sweetness of those cottonwood strokes on Willow Grove that night. Now, going up and down the title stretch, naturally I stopped at pubs, a lot of pubs, and ended up writing 5 river pub poems. I'm going to read one of them. One of them in my hometown ends up with the line, "I can see where perfection is possible, yet still this pint will run out." This one is called River Poems, Desdemona Club, A Gray Day on Gray's Bay. Don't know if anybody knows Astoria very much, but down at the far end of Astoria near the Naked Lady place, there is a dive bar called the Desdemona Club, also known as the Dirty D. This is called, Desdemona, the, of course, Othello's unfortunate wife in Othello, as well as the name of the sandbars below the Astoria Bridge, the Astoria Megler Bridge. River pubs, Desdemona Club, A Gray Day on Gray's Bay. Or it would be. Gray's Bay stretches between Astoria, more or less the Columbia main stem, and the other side of the river, where I live in Gray's River, and Gray's River debouches into Gray's Bay, which debouches into the Columbia. A Gray Day on Gray's Bay, or it would be if you could see it. There is no river view from the Dirty D, in spite of its famous portholes. There's also no well scotch for happy hour, only bourbon, American whiskey. The only scotch at all is Johnny Black at $6.50 per. This in a town founded by Scots. But the shuffleboard in back is free. Nirvana is on the air. And I am almost alone on a Monday afternoon in March. One or two at the bar to keep the pink-haired barmaid company. A couple more clinging to the video poker. But if you could see out and through the shot streaming rain, and if you happened to look north across the river, it would be a very gray day on Gray's Bay. Put out into that murk, turn left like a bar pilot, and with luck, you'll come to the bridge. Beyond lie the Desdemona sands, where as many ill-starred seamen have come to grief as have belly up to the bar in the Dirty D. This dive also named for the unlucky chick in Othello, here at the dark end of town. Just think, had it been a gray day on Gray's Bay on May 11th of 1792, when Robert Gray crossed the bar in the Columbia Redivivo, there would be no Gray's Bay. The Columbia might be named Vancouver's River, and the well whiskey at the Dirty D, it would be Canadian. And we would all have health insurance, by the way. Just a couple more. This story was going to be a novel, but my last novel, which is also my first novel, Magdalena Mountain, took 44 years and 10 drafts before it was ready. And hope you'll read it sometime. I'm writing a sequel to it now called The Silver Satyr, but this was going to be a novel. Make a good one for somebody. Take notes. I decided to write a poem instead, so it's a novel and a poem. Probably better. Save you some time. It's called The Book Boat. He bought a good old tub named Lorraine off an old salt gone to shore on Sylvie Island. barely knew navigation, let alone diesel. So come spring and still afloat, he found a mate. A Warsaw soak, never dried out, in a tavern off Lower Burnside on Water Street. To caulk decks, pump bilge, romance the fickle engine into life. When it began to look like Lorraine might not sink, he built shelves in the hold and started buying books wherever he could. Goodwills and thrifts in the Dalles and St. Helens. Library sales in Rainier and White Salmon. The remainder tables at Powell's. And then, recalling bookmobiles from his boyhood on the plains, he hung his shingle on the bridge and took the book boat on the road, on the river. And so it went, up and down the tidal reach, Bonneville to Baker Bay and back again through the locks, sometimes all the way to Lewiston, laying his wares before the boaters, the fishers, the workers, the loafers, all of them, hungry for good books, though they might not know it. He sold them cheap, gave them away, or, his favorite, bartered for fish, fruit, or laundry. Swapped a late Brian Doyle for a sturgeon. Middlemarch for Maryhill wine. Made enough for ground beef, beer, and diesel. Even the cat got fed, and the mate paid enough for drunken leave ashore. Lorraine became a legend up and down the river. Marinas vied for her, gave free moorage for a night or three, until he started to wonder about the islands, the inside passage, and beyond. So he took Lorraine across the bar and didn't die. Put in at La Push, where he sold all of his Pushkin to a Russian emigre, and a set of Twilight to a wannabe werewolf. And then east up the straits, Nia Bay, CQ, PA, PT, around the corner to Anacortes, and points north. Last rumors came from Kodiak. But even now the Columbia remembers, and there's always a slip open, just in case. So you've read the novel now. Next to last, there's some kind of heavy poems in here too, one called Ceremony, which I wrote for Tia. It turned out I didn't know when I started. You never know where poems going. You shouldn't know when you start. And it was about a little bear, roadkill, broke my heart, but the poem ended up about Tia. I'm not going to read that. Don't think I can. But I'm going to read you a happy poem, and it's a single sentence, a Thoreauvian sentence. Can't get away with it much now, though Duncan tries in Sun House. But it's called What the Muskrat Saw, and I promise you, if anybody can still diagram sentences, anybody think they can still do that? Well, this would diagram, it scans poetically, I hope, but it is also diagrammable. I mean, it's a perfect grammatical sentence, take my word. What the Muskrat Saw. Slipping through the marsh beneath the striders as the beaver, 10 times his size, slid through the pond beside the dam where aspen lay akimbo, stripped of bark above the runnel where the rainbow rose to meet the hatch of caddis at the riffle of the kingfisher's rattle through the willow's shadow on the river where the cottonwood leaf floated over sandy bottoms scored with crayfish holes and rocks all coated with snails whose tentacles quivered at the passage of the blennies and the scissor of the heron's bill, which came up empty for a change because the mink disturbed the fish a moment early and they in turn alarmed a frog that leapt upon a fallen log where otters sunned before returning upstream to the marsh where the muskrat, slipping underneath the striders, saw him and rose into his reedy house. That's my riposte to Wind in the Willows. And I would like to close tonight with all the same thanks I gave before and more that I no doubt forgot. And thank you for coming tonight, sweet people, and this sweet place to be among. Can you be among a place? Yes. This poem was written in and for the little village of Ilwaco at the very mouth of the Columbia on the Washington side by Kip Disappointment. In a bookstore there called Time Enough Books. Anybody know it? Sweet little bookstore. But it could just as well pertain to Anacortes and Pelican Bay Books. There's a bigger place, more going on, but this, the idea is the same. It's called I Cover the Waterfront. Ilwaco, December 2018 for Carla. Anacortes, November 2023 for all of you, Eli and your bunch. Sometimes it seems the hopes of all mankind lie on display in a small town bookstore, against all odds, still open on a bleak December dock, in a time when so much else is going, going, gone. After the reading, I spill out the back door onto the wet green waterfront, walk up and down in the dripping dusk. The slips still have boats, though the fleet is tiny now. Still, a good seafood grill, a pub, and Jesse's Fish Market at the end of the pier persist. I remember Charters by the dozen, the cafe at the end of the spit, Dupe's Hardware as a going concern. But now it's mostly a matter of the riverfront, where the Columbia brushes Baker Bay before dying or being born anew into the ocean itself. And what moves me is not what's gone, but what somehow remains. The boats, the oysters, the books, shiny in the light through the wet window. They speak to the possibility of all things, even in these times, waterfronts do. As long as little seaside towns live on, giving harbor to half-forgotten craft and vagabonds on a winter's night, I will continue to cover the waterfront, seeking something not likely to be found anywhere else. Thank you very much. Thank you all so much. Should we do some Q&A?
We thought it would be important to have a few moments for Abigail and Robert to answer questions and talk about their writing life or anything else we'd like to know. So,
unless we've imparted the sum total of human knowledge, and then we can all go. Drink. Yes, sir.
Were you in McGinney for butterflies?
Yes. Yes, I had finished a PhD improbably in endangered butterfly ecology at Yale. And the first job I got was working for the government of Papua New Guinea to try to come up with a conservation plan for the giant birdwing butterflies that are this big, and at the same time to reform the butterfly trade in New Guinea, which had completely favored expatriate profiteers and also threatened the population. Insects are very hard to overcollect, but these giant birdwings had great value in their small brood sizes, so that was an exception. And so we came up with a reform system to that any income deriving from the insect resource in New Guinea went directly to the villages with no middlemen. And a bunch of black marketeers were deported, and we got a conservation plan laid down for the birdwings, some of which is still being followed and some of which has been much improved on since then. But it made a model for butterfly farming programs that has been followed all over the world, and provided the butterfly livestock that you see at the butterfly houses at places like Seattle Center. So yeah.
Well, what years were you in?
77, and I went back for National Academy of Sciences in 82. So a wonderful job for a young naturalist. Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
How are the bird wings doing now?
Beg pardon?
How are the bird wings doing now?
Well, most of the species are, some of the species are quite common and doing okay. They feed on Dutchman's pipe plants, the Aristolochiaceae, and they're distasteful because of that. And some of them are common, so they're okay. But several of the species are extremely narrowly limited. Ornithoptera paradisea, the paradise birdwing. The Queen Alexandra's birdwing, the biggest butterfly in the world, which I have seen, the females over a foot. And it was first collected with a shotgun. And I've seen the type specimen of that in the British Museum, a little pepper shot. But I've seen the butterfly alive in the canopy too, on the Papuan Peninsula. And that, it's unclear because between German logging, let's see, no, the Japanese logging concessions, British oil palm concessions, and the Germans did something else, and volcanoes, and World War II airfields all over there, the habitat is very, very much reduced. But there's a new birdwing conservation trust that's working on it. Nothing is lost yet, and we hope.
Did you ever give a pigeon name to any of the butterflies?
I have had the honor of naming in recent years 9 new coppers in the northwest corner of the state, subspecies of the Mariposa copper. Mm-hmm. The first one, my late second wife, Sally, and I discovered in at Ozette Prairies in 1975. And for many years, I knew it was distinctive, needed a name, was endangered, and needed a lot of protection. We had to scientifically describe it and name it. And that finally happened when I was able to review the entire species with a colleague at OSU. And so just a couple of years ago, we named 9 new subspecies, most of them named for women who have had important roles in Western butterfly studies. One named for the Cascades, one named for its iridescent color, and so on. But so those are in the process of being studied and listed now. And the first one, that kicked the whole thing off is called the Macaw Copper because it was on the Macaw lands and this national park that had been Macaw lands where we found it. So yeah, that's been my honor. I've had one animal named for me and it's a millipede. Lumisiella paellii, the Bill Leonard found at Crest Novoselic's forest.